Welcome to Life List, a birding podcast.
Hello, hello. Welcome, welcome, everybody. This is George Armistead. I am here with Molly Brown and Alvaro Jaramillo. We are Life List, a birding podcast. Thanks for being here. Guys, how are you doing today?
Doing great. Yeah.
Nice.
Really feels like spring migration time here today. So.
Yes. Weather's looking good.
Second in a row that we're all together.
How about that?
Yeah.
Gotta like that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we should be birding. I don't know what we're doing here, but.
Well, there is that. Yeah. Yeah, it's true. I got out a little bit this morning.
I did too.
Yeah. I can't say I saw a whole lot, but I did have like my first black-throated green warblers of the year. Ooh. My first eastern kingbirds, which is always like, you know, fun. Just such a great, great bird, and Tyrannus. But yeah, I still feel like it was a little sluggish. I don't know about you, Molly, but I feel like the migration is like, it's like, you know, what is it, May 5th now? I feel like it should be gangbusters today, and hopefully will be tomorrow for this walking big day. But
yeah,
I don't know.
I think tomorrow will be good for you. It's been okay here, really. Starting to get some more of like the true migrants. I had some flycatchers this morning that were at first of year. A lot of our breeding birds are back, so which is, you know, a good mix of warblers in these parts, and just sort of a steady stream of migrants, but nothing crazy. But I'm not unhappy with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I'm craving for more.
When we hear the migrations, the visible migration that I see in my local patch is shorebirds and loons. So, you know, right now, kind of a little bit of a loon movement, and that goes until June, actually early June. But, you know, 40 whimbrels or so this morning, and 30 plus sanderling all on the beach with some willets, and that's not what you see in the winter. So you really sort of April and May, you start seeing all those shorebirds moving through, and sort of another species or two here and there. So that that's sign of spring for me, you know, and the swallows arriving, violet green swallows.
Nice.
That's cool. Hey, this just reminded me of something I was thinking about this morning that I'll throw out to you all. I was thinking about my yard list where we're living now, which sort of overlooks some construction and some businesses and whatnot, and you can see a good ways from here. And I realized in the last big snowy owl eruption year that there was one here in Morgantown, and you can see where I saw it from our house. And I was wondering if that would count as a yard bird if I saw it before I was actually living here. Like, does that go on my yard list?
You know, I think this is a real good question. I mean, I'm all about making the game more fun. So I think what you could do is, you know, you set up your yard list and you e-bird it from the time you saw it. And
that's a good point.
You know, then it falls under that personal location of yours. I can see Alvaro giving a deep sigh here, as though he is not happy with this.
Actually funny. I don't know. I was thinking about what like my best yard birds have been here, and I have like the personal location that I created. And I had looked on eBird the other day and realized that I had one spot that was here that wasn't. You know, like within my personal location, and it's that from a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a messy map now.
Yeah.
So a couple of people have talked to me about my opinion on George's, what was it again? It wasn't actually in Philly, but you counted it as such.
Well, there's a couple birds I have seen from the river, like the Delaware River, that were arguably in New Jersey.
Yeah, see, that was my point there. That in those, there's a definition item there, right? So the fact that the bird itself wasn't in Philly, to me, makes a difference. But if you're yard listing, if the bird isn't in your yard, it doesn't matter. It's like you've defined your yard to be what you see from your yard, not that it's in your yard. Some people actually right. define it as in your yard. So I think there's a definition thing there. But I would say with the owl, that was not your yard at the time.
Yeah, I guess what I was failing to think about too is like, did you actually see it from what is your yard now? Or did
well,
you?
Well, and I didn't. I saw yeah. it from
then that's a little you know, messy.
The road that I walk from yeah. there. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I would eBird that as the site where the owl was, but I wouldn't eBird it from your yard.
Yeah.
Post.
Because I will say that I actually I eBirded from our yard before we purchased the house. But I was like I just threw a little eBird list together. I think I had like it was like October. We looked at this place, and I had like ospreys going yeah. over, and I was like, wow, there's like a little bit of a hawk movement, you know, here. So I just like threw a little eBird list on, and I pulled that into the yard list. There was nothing really mm-hmm. exceptional, but I was actually on the property that we're on now. I didn't quite own it yet. It wasn't my yard yet, but. And I don't yeah. feel like if a scissor-tailed flycatcher had flown over that day, I think I'd still be counting it. But you know.
yeah. just something I'll talk about with my yard list. It's like an unofficial addition. But yeah, when we were looking at land, I did a checklist on every property we went on.
mm-hmm, just in case.
They're all there. Yep.
Yep.
It was a factor in the buying decision.
In the end, it's your list.
Mm-hmm. He says, he says, not without judgment. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, it's not on my list. Letters. It's not going letters. On my list. Mm. But I was thinking about it as I was walking the dogs this morning.
Certainly would be tempting, understandably. Yeah.
But honestly, I have gotten several people that I've been burning, and it's like, I've been thinking about what you said to George on the podcast regarding his blah, blah, blah. That was, and it's really divided.
Yeah, I know. I know.
Like, you know, you're right on. You're right. He shouldn't count that. The others are like, you know what? He was in Philly seeing that thing. He should count it. You know,
it's a real divider. Know? Yeah. Like around here. Like the first time it came up kind of on our chat group here, like the text, you know, there's like a text group for rare stuff here. And then we have another group that's just for chatter. Like, you know, mm-hmm. pretty much everything's pretty much fair game, you know, within reason. And it came up there, and I was like, well, just so you know, this is how I've been doing it. You know, I'm not saying everybody has to do it this way or whatever, but like I'm adhering to eBird protocol, and this is, you know, according to eBird protocol, I'm good doing this. And there's a couple folks that were like, you know, that is not cool. Like we are against that. And I was like, all right, that's fine. Yeah. You know?
Yeah. It's almost like sports talk, you know, where it's like, was the ball in or out, you know, it's like, it's mm-hmm. definitely like a call.
Yeah.
Yep.
we don't have like a ref to make the call for us. So we're actually making the call for ourselves, which is, yeah.
Yeah.
ABA, step in.
Yeah, we need a ruling.
That's right. Another thing that happened recently on my list, there are a lot of bob whites around that are getting reported in this general area this spring, which is not usual. There was one that popped up in a spot the other night that I was at, and I was thinking that it was going to filter out on my eBird list, so I eBirded it without thinking about it. Otherwise, I don't typically do like an escape eBird. But I guess in West Virginia, all the bob whites count, and that's that.
Yeah, that's another one that's discussed before is a frustrating one for me. Yeah.
Yeah, I went back and listened to the first 5 minutes of the podcast, but then I was looking on eBird. It says escapee, that it's something to the effect of it being not a native species in that area. And there's not really a categorization for a released bird that is a native bird.
Huh. You know, this came up the other day too. Getting back to the ABA and its rulings on things. So you once a state accepts a let's say red mass parakeet, right? You know, it's established. You can, and then the ABA accepts it for the ABA area. You can count that bird anywhere in the ABA area, even if it's like Michigan, right? That makes no sense.
Mm-hmm. I know.
Absolutely no sense.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think the ABA has said, well, we are only you know, talking about ABA, what is in or out of the ABA checklist, you decide the rest. But it seems like that's not right. They need to.
I understand it though. Ruling. Yeah, but then you're like looking at every single monk parakeet population and evaluating, trying to evaluate it, or you know every
you don't, right?
Every scaly-breasted munia.
If that state has already accepted it as a valid species, then you can count it for that state. But if it hasn't,
yeah.
You shouldn't.
Yeah, I think that's fair. If a state records committee has basically said this is now a functioning part of the avifauna, then sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think there's something there that needs to be resolved because that's just messy.
Yeah. No, it's messy anyway. Yeah. Anyway, you slice it, pretty messy.
I know.
Yeah. Say this again. This isn't how I thought it was, but if it is accepted in one state, then across the entire ABA area, it's countable under ABA. Is that what you're saying?
Once a state accepts it, then the ABA checklist committee then accepts it for the ABA area, and then you can count it anywhere in the ABA area. You know,
you're saying should, Alvaro, that's what you're saying should be the case.
I think that's what happens now, right?
Yeah.
What I think should be the case is once the ABA accepts it, you can only count it in states that have accepted it or provinces that have accepted it. But, you know, I'm actually on the ABA checklist committee. I should talk to the committee. I mean, do they say,
it'd be great if we could get an informed opinion.
So, you know, I just vote on stuff. I don't, you know, my opinions are all here.
I didn't think that was the case, so I dropped a link for you guys. Because if you go to the ABA introduced species page, it has current countable populations.
Yeah, I was going to say, I thought that they had actually revised this since last.
Really?
Yeah.
Who's this they you're talking about?
Talking about you, man.
Great question.
Talking about you.
Yeah, gosh, I should pay more attention to most things I do in my life. But
I got to say, I'm looking here at this list you sent, Molly. I forgot that Plain Chachalaca was once introduced and established on Sapelo Island, Georgia. Mm-hmm. But have you seen the meme going around about how the relative of the Plain Chachalaca that gets a lot less fanfare is the Boom Chachalaca? I really love that.
I've seen that on non-birding sites.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Everybody likes that.
Yeah, you gotta love a Boom Chachalaca. Yeah. For sure. So, shifting gears slightly, I think probably our listeners do not know because we haven't really talked about this much, but we are going to, how shall I say this? Try to structure our podcasts a little bit more than we have. We've been pretty footloose and fancy free, if you will. But I think we're going to have sort of more clear seasons going ahead. And we're actually going to take a break coming up in June. When this airs towards the end of May, this will be the last podcast for a month for folks. Hopefully that will be cause for a little bit of a tug at the heartstrings and nothing too much more.
That's the bad news.
Yeah. Good news is that once we come back, we're going to have more regular pods. We're going to try to go weekly and maybe keep them a little bit shorter than we've been doing, but have more episodes overall. So we'll see how that works out. That's the plan. But I think we're going to not have anything for June and then not have anything for December at the end of the year. But knowing that this was going to be our last pod for a while and that, you know, this represents kind of the halfway mark for 2023, I thought it might be interesting to kind of review, you know, what we've done so far for 2023 in terms of not like a big review, but like, you know, highlights. What do you guys have any favorite birding moments or favorite birds from 2023? Maybe we've talked about some of them already. Maybe not, but Yeah, I was just curious. I kind of thought through mine leading into this show. But I was curious if you guys had any. Alvaro, do you have you got any, does anything jump to your mind from first half of 2023 that was a real highlight?
Boy, I haven't really looked at my Ebird lists, you know, but something happened the other day, which was sort of a problematic bird in yet also a great bird, which is on the last day that I was in Bhutan, in Paro, I was right along, we were right along the river staying overnight in a hotel there. And we were leaving that day, but I couldn't, you know, I was going to sleep in. We had a sort of a sleep-in morning, but I couldn't sleep in. I just couldn't. So I got up and I thought, I'll just walk along the river by myself. And I saw a bird we did not see on the tour at all on that morning, which doesn't count for the tour, but it was a really cool bird, the solitary snipe, that gave me a beautiful look. I've only seen this thing once before in Japan, and it was a big deal to try to find it in Japan. It's not easy. In fact, it may not be easy anywhere. So I felt really bad. We just couldn't get to it with the group. You know, everybody's already packed up and ready to go by the time, you know, we were having breakfast. But that was a lot of fun for me, just because it's a bird I had wanted to see again, and I like shorebirds, and the fact that it just sort of came out of nowhere, I wasn't expecting it, was
fantastic. And that the thing was like right at your feet, basically, it looked like, basically, from the photos.
Yeah, yeah, it was a good look at a good bird. And you know, this is a species that actually has been in Alaska at least once, right?
It was twice now. Twice. Well, yeah, I actually remember this because the first time it showed up, I think it was Gavin Bieber out on St. Paul Island, the Pribilofs. He, you know, it was difficult conditions, difficult weather, but he got a photo, and I remember looking at it right away and being like, oh my God, that's a solitary snipe. Yeah. And even though the photo, it's sort of like a, you know, they're a big, big round thing, you know, and they're a pretty snipe and a cool bird. Like you mentioned in your post on this bird that they like different kind of habitat than most other snipes.
They're more river, rocky rivers seem to be key for them as opposed to, you know, marshes. And the two times I've seen them, but been on rivers, and one in winter in Japan, they take creeks, rivers, that kind of thing. So yeah, it's unusual. You know, it's not where you'd be looking for a snipe. It's more like, you know, spotted sandpiper habitat almost, you know?
Yes. Or a dipper. Yeah. Like I've only seen it once, this bird. It was when we were doing the snow leopard trip last year, and we were kind of camped out at one of the spots, and I still don't know how he spotted it, but Doug Gottschfeld like picked this thing from, you know, in a scope way down one of these rocky creeks, like you're talking about. It was a bird all of us wanted to see. And we were thrilled to see it the way we did. It would have been a difficult creek to get down to the bottom of it to get anywhere near this bird, but just to see it was a thrill. Mm-hmm. So when you posted that thing the other day, I was like, look at that. It's like, like right at his feet. It's ridiculous. Right. You ought to be ashamed of yourself.
So yeah. So I'm ashamed to mention that my favorite bird during a tour was a bird that wasn't on the tour. You know, it's like talk about bad guiding etiquette, but it was what happened, you know, like it's sort of one of those things. So I kind of almost didn't want to mention it, but I'm really happy to have seen it. So.
Well, I have to say the bird that I envied of you on that trip was white-bellied heron, which kind of likes sort of similar habitat almost, right? Bigger rivers, I guess, but
bigger rivers. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And incredibly rare. I mean, I think, what are we talking about now? They're thought to be like 300 left in the world or something like this.
Yeah. It's,
and a big heron, big, like bigger than great blue.
And looks like, less than 300. It looks like.
And most of them are in Bhutan, and it had a distribution that was much wider, like all the way, you know, to Myanmar and all this, you know, and parts of China and so forth. So it's, It's a superbly rare and declining species, now has a breeding center that's been established by folks in Bhutan and through also the, you know, International Crane Center. They're involved there too. So it's not a bird most people have even heard of. I think, special in that because it relies on rivers. The quality of rivers and river habitat in Asia is really an issue, right? Because very few pristine rivers in Asia. And we've seen that with like river dolphins and other things, you know, that have become quite rare in India and so forth. So this is one of those birds that, I mean, needs not only protection, but habitat protection. Like, I'm not sure what is happening to the rivers that's making them become less, you know, good as habitat. Like the fish populations must be changing or something, but it is definitely not a bird that's on the radar for most birders. Yet you go to Bhutan and it's a flagship species.
And a
good one too. And we saw
one of the alternate names for that bird is Imperial Heron. And I feel like if that was the English name rather than white-bellied heron, it might be like an easier conservation project to like, it might be easier to raise money for a bird like that was named Imperial Heron.
Right.
If folks don't, you know, looking for a search image, it's in the same it's in the genus Ardea, same genus as great blue heron. I think does it average larger than great blue heron?
It looks bigger. It's
But it's kind of plumaged more like a tricolored heron a little bit. Yeah,
It's like a giant mutated tricolor heron.
Yeah,
from photos anyway.
It's funny, I hadn't thought about it that way because it's very gray and white. You know?
Yeah, I guess I'm looking at a breeding plumage one here. I mean, it doesn't look like a tricolored heron. Of course, they're pretty distinctive shape wise. But
this is like a thick legged, you know, big bodied heron. To me, it almost looks like the structure of a Goliath heron, not quite as big.
And completely different habitat.
I mean, this is such a difficult question. What's your favorite bird, even of just a few months of this year?
Sure.
Countless ones. You know what I mean? And let's face it. I mean, as I'm talking to you all, there are flocks of band-tailed pigeons going north. Just unusual. Like there's been so many band-tail pigeons that went south this year and they're moving north like a spectacle of them. I'm like, right now, that's my favorite bird today. You know, like that's the one I'm thinking about. So it's a difficult question, but pass the mic. Who's your favorite, Molly?
Yeah. Well, it's actually an easy answer for me so far this year. There's an experience I loved, which isn't an especially uncommon bird or anything, but it was the lyre-tailed nightjar on our Columbia trip. So George was actually not with us for this night, and it was just a few nights into the tour.
Better.
But
that was what really made it, wasn't it, Molly?
He didn't see it. In the UK.
And I was kind of thinking about not going out that night too, which was only a few nights in, and I had no excuse not to. I just like to sleep and I'm not good at staying up late. But it was right in, I don't know, second or third day of the tour, and our local guide Fabio had a spot in this newer area that's accessible for birding, Bosque Check, which I think we talked about in one of our Columbia episodes, but it's just a massive sort of border area that's between I think National Park and Manizales, and it's like got water treatment facilities, but it's got a giant protected area that's now
isn't it owned by like the equivalent of the water department there? Basically, it's land that they have to like kind of protect the watershed. Yeah.
It's huge. I don't know like the acreage, but we hit up different areas. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Where we were birding earlier that morning or the day before, was, I don't know, 20 miles away. And it was still part of the area of just, you know, like the gravel road that you go down. But yeah, there is a spot that had water treatment facilities that he knew of where there were night jars that were sometimes around. So it was just a matter of like seeing if it would work out, if we could go check it out at night, that sort of thing, kind of getting the okays. And then I think our whole group went. So that was good. But yeah, we just pulled up to the right spot at the right time, and there was a pair just, I mean, feet away. It was so mind blowing. And there was also some light because it was like in a spot that had some like people working overnight and that sort of thing. And I mean, it's like looking at nighthawks around, like you can go up to the mall parking lot here at night and they're swarming around the lights. And that's basically what this pair was doing. So it was the last time I like lost it over a bird. I was so excited. I was tired. That probably made me more excited. And then I realized that like half of the group was kind of watching me as much as they were watching the bird because I was so excited about it. Wow. That was just really, really fun. Fun night, fun experience. One of those things where you're like on a gravel road for a while and we were, you know, not sure if it was going to be worth it to kind of pull up and see it or not. And it paid off quite well.
Yeah, that was awesome. And I think part of what was cool about it was that it was impromptu, right? Like we, yeah, it was not planned. And yeah, I definitely like talking to everybody at breakfast the next morning. I was like, oof, that was, I might have opted out of the wrong field trip. Yeah. Yeah, that was a great one. I had a couple that I was going to detail, and I'll try to keep it to sort of a minimum.
You know, while you were talking, Molly, like you probably saw me, I was like shuffling around, like move, you know, got the binoculars up. A young male Lasley Bunting just stopped in the backyard. Oof. Migrant. Mm. And I don't see them every year here. So that's a, like, I was like trying to reach for the camera and like, how do I do this? You know, trying to get a picture of this thing. And it was sitting right up on top of this little bush and it's gone. But, yeah. Migration's happening, man. That was cool.
That is cool.
Yeah. There are, Carolina Wren fledglings in the bush outside. There are three, oof, of them and they're hanging out and that's what I'm watching. During,
yeah. Those are pretty absurdly cute. Yeah.
They're adorable. Lots of baby birds here this week.
Nice.
There's tons out.
Baby birds. All right, George. So what's your fave?
Yeah, I mean, I've got some honorable mentions that I'll just mention quickly. Ruby topaz hummingbird was a bird I've kind of just like missed a few times that finally connected with in Columbia this year. And like, I think I got to the point where I was almost forgetting about it. And then one appeared on tour and we actually ended up seeing a couple on that same trip around the Santa Marta's. But I was like, when the first one appeared, I was like, oh, right, these things exist and they're amazing looking. So that was pretty cool. And I think probably, you know, one of the best days of birding I've really had ever, but for this year, and this year has been remarkable for me, actually. I was fifth in the world in eBird for like 2 or 3 days there. Cause I, you know, after a big bunch of time in Colombia and Tanzania, it was just, you know, just kind of by the chance of my schedule, I ended up just kind of racking up species. And, at some point I looked at the top 100 and I realized I was like, hi. Now, since then, I've gone down a lot because, you know, the people that are up high are really chugging along. But it was fun to like kind of realize I was seeing a lot of birds there for a while, which was really cool. But I think one of the best days was that day that we had the Oncilla, this, you know, special little cat up there high in the Andes. It was pretty awesome. And that same day, I like got photos of rusty winged barbtail and tawny breasted tinamou and chestnut crested catingas. It was a pretty great day with Paolo Rendon. That was basically just some personal birding up there. That was a ton of fun. That was great. And in Tanzania, there were two birds in particular I was super excited to see. One was Shallows Turaco, which I'd actually seen before on my previous trip, but it was real brief. And this trip got to see it much better. Unfortunately, not everybody in the group got to see it because we were kind of spread out at the time, but I even got some photos of that. And rufous-bellied heron, which is a cool bird, often in kind of thick rank marshy vegetation. It was in the same genus as like green heron and striated heron for a while, but now they've got it with the pond herons, but it's kind of this all dark heron with rufous belly. And that was a bird I've been wanting to see for a while. That was cool. But actually, Molly, my favorite was of the year, I figured, was the rufous-fronted parakeets up in the central Andes there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Like, and I remember you were like on the phone, like trying to like, you know, I think we can say this now without getting you into trouble, but you were like trying to like have like a business meeting, like, you know, it just happened to fall at that moment.
It just popped up. Yeah. We'd like had a really good birding day. I had to make one call like that week that mattered. And we were planning to be at our hotel like a few hours earlier. I was like, man, I've got service. I've got to take this.
Was like, that was a bird I told Roger, like I'd done that trip several times and not seen those rufous-fronted parakeets. And, you know, it's a critically endangered bird. I think there's less than 2,000 now, and they're declining. They're, you know, it's a rare bird. It's in the genus Bulbarynchus. I've seen a couple others in that genus. They're just cool, usually montane parakeets, hard to see, see well, at least. And this was one I told Roger, I was like, I don't believe they exist. You know, this is like what, my fourth trip here or something. And I've still not seen these things. I think they're just like a figment of people's imagination. And, you know, and so we kind of were working along trying to find them, and then got that call from Yesenia, went back, had them. We got out of the car, basically heard them calling right away, managed to see them. And they were kind of in and out of sight. And it was like, it was not amazing views, but I also felt like we really got to see them in their element, you know, up on this slope, moving around, calling a lot. That was special bird to see. And, you know, it was cool that Yesenia called us to go back and get it because she knew we were looking for him. So, yeah, it was just kind of like cool community, cool, you know, cool like birding, you know, moment. It was like memorable that you were like trying to see these things and enjoy them while like on a Zoom call at the same time. And like, you know, it was just a great bird that I've been wanting to see for a while. So I think that was probably my favorite of 2023 so far. But of course, there are 6 months to go still. So
that's great.
Well, those are some good moments. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Well, one other thing we wanted to do today, and we got a scoot here in a little bit earlier than normal today, but we have gotten quite a bit of feedback from folks on different things, and we were going to like kind of run through some of the feedback we've gotten from listeners and just talk about some of the feedback we've gotten.
Yeah, we get a good bit of listener mail, and that's super fun. So we do need to catch up on answering those, but we talk about them a lot between emails, and we were just catching up on stuff here too. And also just a ton of reviews on Apple Podcasts, and that's pretty fun. There's some good stuff to read on there. But yeah, should we start by talking about food?
Yeah, that was a good one. Was somebody brought that up on a trip and brought it up before, was like, when you're on a trip and, you know, some places the food is great, some places it's fine. Usually where we go, it's not terrible. Sometimes it's not inspiring particularly. But often I do feel like we've got our creature comforts that when we get home, we seek out. Like when you get home, like what are you jonesing for in terms of your first meal back, right? Mm-hmm. And, yeah, I know for me, Molly, I actually took you to TNF Farmers Market near my place here, which is like my favorite sandwich shop. And they have, you know, it's a proper deli. Everything's, you know, everything's fresh and real. And that's where we took that picture with the pre-made tomato pie, which I have to say is if you're going to eat tomato pie, which, you know, of course, it's not something I endorse. But if you're going to, that would not be the way to do it. But they do make amazing, deli sandwiches there. And I think I would say whenever I come back from a long trip within a matter of 2 to 3 days, I'm over there ordering some kind of hoagie, you know, or whatever the special is. Very often I'll just get the standard Italian hoagie, 'cause that is like just really speaks to me of home. That's probably mine.
Yeah. I really like this question because I have a pattern that I follow at this point. So first off, before I go on a trip, typically get Italian the night before. There's a very big Italian population around here and a lot of good Italian restaurants. And that also generally loads Jimmy up with leftovers for a few days because he doesn't like to cook. So it's just like a good system to kind of close out before I take off. So I do that and have some pasta. And then after about a week or so, I'm really craving buffalo wings when I'm not home. Mm. And that's what I go home and we get wings. That's nice. Typically like the return meal. Yeah.
Comfort food. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, we have a lot of buffalo wings, actually. So that's our regular.
Nice. What about you, Al?
There are tours that have great food where you, like, the one coming up now for me, Japan, is perhaps the best. Like, it is amazing. Hawaii, great food.
Yeah, that was always one of my favorites, yeah.
I think that the chili has really come along, you know, in terms of food. So there's some trips where I'm like, almost like the food is so good. I'm not kind of craving much, you know, when I get home. But there are other tours where the food's repetitive, what have you. Like, actually, Bhutan can get repetitive in terms of food. So weirdly enough, the thing that I crave when I get back is an IPA, a beer.
It's funny. Yeah.
Yeah. When you're, especially if you're into IPAs, a lot of other beer, and in particular tropical beers, you know, and the classic Latin American beer, it's just
not as satisfying.
Satisfying whatsoever.
We talked about this in Colombia.
Yeah.
I mean, there's some good beers starting out actually in the more temperate regions in South America, but really, you know, everybody has their national beer and they go crazy over it. You know, Aguila in Colombia, or Gallo in Guatemala, and so forth. But, you know, they're all kind of the same. Sorry to say. You know?
Yeah. I know. Definitely risk offending a big block of friends of ours by saying that. But I agree with you, Alvaro. And I feel that, like, sometimes I get home and I'll, like, sit down at a pub or something and realize that I'm about to drink a nice, you know, hazy IPA and be like, oh, yes. Sweet nectar of the gods. Yeah. After, you know, a couple, 3 weeks of something that is, you know, fine, but not great. It makes a difference.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, and it's funny that beer is the one thing, I mean, maybe I'm probably just not going to the places that have great beer, you know, in terms of tours, but, wine, we have great wine in a lot of the places we tour.
Yeah.
And there's other things to eat and drink, but beer tends to be, you know, not so amazing in many places I travel.
It's definitely getting better in a lot of Central and South America. Like, there are, like, you know, Bogota Beer Company, and there's some other microbrews that are popping up now in Colombia, for example, that you're like, ooh, this is nice. It's got some body and some flavor, you know?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. So there you go, beer.
Yeah, nice.
Good answer.
What else we got, Molly? I know one I should address, I guess, that we were discussing earlier was from Leszek Wilnick, who, when we were talking in Colombia, the bird fair, I pointed out one of Roger's favorite pieces of trivia, which is that the word murciélago, which means bat, like, you know, the flying mammals, was the only word in Spanish that had all the vowels. Now, Leszek has pointed out that this is very much not the case. And he took exception to that piece of trivia, which is inaccurate, and provided a couple others, including educación and consecuencia, as a couple others. And I'm sure now, looking at these words, that there are probably some others as well. But thanks, Leszek, for pointing that one out.
Yeah, I like that correction.
I would suggest to Leszek Wilnick that he might get some more vowels for his own name, you know, because I'm just joking.
Or maybe just get rid of the vowels altogether and go all consonants.
Right. You know? All consonants, you know, yeah. like and then pronounce it Charlie.
That's funny. Yeah, that was a fun piece of mail to get. What was the other question? Oh, yes. I have one from Heath in Australia, who's visiting the U.S. next year and wanted to know advice for international birders who are visiting the U.S. for the places that we recommend to visit.
That's a good one. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I feel like if you're a foreigner, you know, Texas gets you a lot. Because you can get sort of the Southeast specials there in East Texas. A lot of these, you know, like Pine Woods, Southeastern things, brown-headed nuthatches, Carolina chickadees, you know, probably even red cockaded woodpeckers there someplace. I'm not sure. But, you know, from East Texas on down the coast, down to South Texas, that's just, you know, you do that in April, you're going to clean up a lot.
That makes a lot of sense.
Add the hill country in and some
getting your mix right
and some valley stuff. If you're coming from outside the U.S. and you want to get a good wallop of birds, that'd be a pretty good way to start out.
Mm-hmm. Just thinking, the migration is really good there. Although, you know, the Great Lakes migration in May is so outstanding, you know, and we've talked about that, you know, in the past, you know, Point Pelee or Ohio. It's just so amazing and so much is going through and you don't have to travel much to see a lot. So the birds are going past you in a sense.
Mm-hmm. That's kind of what I was going to say, actually. I've always thought that it would be pretty cool for international birders to come to the U.S., especially this time of year. And if you started even in like a big airport like New York City or D.C. or over that way, and maybe made a bit of a loop and you kind of got some eastern shore birds there and then cut up to the Great Lakes and did that and you kind of got a swath of your breeding birds too. And then I've thought it'd be pretty cool if you just worked your way up the Northeast coast and ended up getting like toward Maine or up that way, that would be a really fun trip. I'm very partial to the East and these trees and this kind of environment this time of year. So
I was gonna say, especially this time of year, like I try to be home in May. I think it's hard to be any place better. It's just the Mid-Atlantic, East Coast, with the warblers, the shorebird migration. There's just, I mean, it's pretty darn great. Pretty tough to beat.
Yeah.
There is one aspect that, a sort of another viewpoint of it, is like if you're from away, it depends on where you're from, right? What might strike you as really cool. So if you're from Europe, you're seeing migration, you're seeing, you know, birds coming through and you've got different warblers, different sparrowy type things. But what might be more distinctive and unique is the West and Southwest.
Yeah.
In terms of what you see and just thrashers or, you know, desert birds.
Southern California, give you a lot.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And then you can do pelagics, right, as well, if you're in California, and see all the ocean stuff, including whales, which everybody loves.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, not everybody, but most people.
Everybody reasonable.
They got to like whales and penguins.
And owls.
Yeah.
And owls.
Well, and this wouldn't be maximizing your species list at all, but for like swath of America kind of thing. Josh Coville and I met him at his home in around Glacier National Park, and we drove down to Arizona last August. And just like working your way north to south through that part of the U.S., just the changes in scenery and birds. I mean, especially once you get further south and you cut that in, that was pretty cool. You hit a lot of big U.S. landmarks and that sort of thing too. So it's pretty fun.
Yeah, that's a good subtle plug, Molly. Intentional or not, for Josh's tour with Hillstar Nature Glacier to that's Grasslands. Right. Yeah, it's we cover all that ground. It's really nice. Yeah, yeah, yeah. We just got a couple minutes left here. I know that that Bart Hutchinson's gotten in touch with us, and he really wants to hear the nitty gritty, the gnarly and naughty stuff that happens on trips. We could probably dedicate more than one episode just to that. But I do think it'd be worth at some point, probably don't have time for it today, to chat about the, some birding etiquette stuff. Whether it's, seat rotation on tour, or, sharing scopes, and there's some stuff there, birding etiquette in general, that I think would be worth examining. So we do need to dig into that. Were there any others we could touch on quickly before we sign off?
Yeah. I had a question from my friend Nate here in West Virginia about what we have coming up. So we can wrap up with that if you want, just like tour birding wise over the second half of the year.
Yeah. What do you got coming up, Al?
What do I have coming up? Well, Galapagos, I'm going in a few days to Japan, Birds and Wine. I'm trying to think, all these trips are full right now.
that's a real good problem to have. Yeah,
I know. But probably Peter Burke is going to go back to Bolivia, so that'll be a cool one. And pelagics. We have our first pelagic. It'll have happened by the time this airs in May, and then they start going in June. And amazingly enough, we've got something like 30-something pelagics, and they're already about 1/3 sold, like the spots, which is way higher than we've ever had before. It's, I think, the post COVID thing, that people are just traveling now. So there you go.
Nice. Yeah. For me, I've got Uganda at the end of the year, which just sold out, and we got a great group for that. I am super excited. Molly, we're going to retrace some of the steps that you and I did back then. But we're also going to hit a few spots that I've not been to before. Yeah, I'm super excited about that. We got a great group coming. So look forward to detailing that when the time comes. What about you, Molly?
Yeah, well, that's a good plug for me, because we do have a group that's looking at going to Uganda as well, for the Birding Co-op in December. So if you're interested in that, reach out. And we've got a little bit of a different tour. It's a little bit shorter and just focusing on a couple spots for gorillas and shoebills and that sort of thing. And the past several years, a group of us from the co-op have done a big Arizona trip in August, and really looking forward to that too. That's always a good time. So those are the big things they have.
Nice.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, we got to scoot, but thanks so much, everybody, for listening. Thanks to Koa Sport Optics for being our sponsor. We will be gone for June, but we will be back at you in July. Thanks for listening, everybody, and talk to you guys soon.
Bye, everyone.